Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening also to our radio audience. Welcome to the fifth seminar in the annual series, Work in Progress in the Social Studies. Tonight, our speakers are Professor Peter Mayo from the Faculty of Education of the University of Malta, and Dr. Carmel Borge, the Dean of the Faculty of Education, and they will be reading a paper entitled Challenges for Critical Pedagogy, A Southern European Perspective. May I briefly take this opportunity to tell you that the next seminar in the series will be after the Easter vacation on Wednesday, 6 April, and Dr. Mary Darmanin will address the topic Gender and the Digital Divide, Who Knows, Who Cares? So that's Mary Darmanin on April 6th. But now it gives me great pleasure to hand over to tonight's speakers, Carmel Borge and Peter Mayo.
Well, first of all, thanks for coming. A paper we'll be presenting, Carmel and I, this evening, Challenges for Critical Pedagogy, A Southern European Perspective, is a paper which is going to be published in a journal produced by SAGE, called Cultural Studies Critical Methodologies. But we still consider this to be a work in progress because we intend putting out a book on which will comprise our writings on education, those we've done together. And there's room to develop this paper further. Also because we were tied by word limits when with regard to our journal contribution. Now, as some of you know, critical pedagogy is a very important school of thinking in education, primarily located in the United States, which draws a lot on a variety of perspectives. Originally, it drew a lot on the Frankfurt School and on a host of other writers. The key names you would get in the United States would be Henry Giroux, who is now in Canada, Michael Apple, a curriculum specialist, Bell Hooks, Peter McLaren, who is a Canadian based in the United States, Roger Simon, but there are many others, Jennifer Gore, Kathleen Wyler, Antonia Darder, etc., etc. The issues are many, which are broached. There was a focus on social class at the very beginning, but then, being in the United States, it's inevitable to address the issue of race and ethnicity. Gender is a very important topic in critical pedagogy. There are critiques of critical pedagogy itself, within critical pedagogy, and also outside it. And what we are trying to do here is, we were both trained in this particular perspective. We both received our training in North America, in Canada, but we are attempting to bring critical pedagogy closer to home. And we have previous to this done some work on the Mediterranean, but we think it makes more sense to talk from a Southern European perspective because we'll be addressing here primarily what we consider to be the big issue for the Mediterranean and the big challenge for education in this part of the world, which is the issue of migration. And that's the key topic in our paper. And I think it's only fair to say that we are looking at it from the vantage point of two people who are located in Malta, which is therefore very much from the Southern European side of the Mediterranean, the receiving end, if you like, which is one of the biggest ironies, as we will say in our paper. This part of the world exported so much labor power in the past, now it's become a net importer of labor power. And we must keep that in mind, because that will probably teach us a few things as to how to welcome migrants to our shores. Okay, I'd like to start, and you can follow on the screen our PowerPoint presentation. Like all regions of the world, Southern Europe and the larger Mediterranean area are under the sway of the phenomenon commonly referred to as globalization, a process that, strictly speaking, has always been a feature of the capitalist mode of production, characterized by periodical economic reorganization and an ongoing quest for the exploration of new markets and drawing more people into capitalist relations of production. In fact, it is more appropriate in the present historical conjuncture to use the phrase the intensification of globalization. Migrations represent more than a phenomenon, a historical certainty that can be found today, though with different features in all countries and in particular in the most developed, and I would actually add industrially developed. Migration phenomena are becoming more and more important within the Mediterranean basin. End of quote. With Southern Europe witnessing mass-scale immigration from North Africa, the Mediterranean plays an important role in this process, serving, in the view of many, as a kind of Rio Grande. Reminds us of what happened in North America, from Tijuana to San Diego, etc. We also face very similar issues in terms of exploitation of clandestine workers, anyway, I'll get to that later on. As both of us have written elsewhere, it can be argued with respect to the movement of people from the southern Mediterranean to the northern Mediterranean and beyond, that the spectre of the violent colonial process the old continent initiated has come back with a vengeance to haunt it. I mean, Europe created this spectre and has come back to haunt it. This is the price that Europe has to pay, in my view, for its colonial past, its colonial history, Europe and the Eurocentric world. This process, which are not the same, by the way, this process is facilitated by the economic requirements of highly industrialized countries with respect to certain types of labor, and the consideration that these requirements cannot be satisfied by the internal labor market, despite the high levels of unemployment experienced within these countries. This gives rise to the presence of guest workers, who are often victims of terrible exploitative situations in terms of payment, conditions of work, and the precariousness of their existence within the borrowed context. And here's a parallel with San Diego, what is known as the San Diego syndrome. It's a point which was addressed by Paulo Freire, a key figure in critical pedagogy, because I mentioned the Frankfurt School earlier on, but, you know, Paulo Freire would be one of the key figures in critical pedagogy, to whom reference will be made throughout this piece, in view of the fact that he represents a voice from the South that speaks to concerns of the South. In a book called Pedagogy of Hope, published in 1994, Freire refers to his work in Geneva when he came in contact through meetings and projects with guest workers from Italy, Spain, Portugal, Greece, Turkey, and Arab countries. These migrant guest workers enabled Freire, on his own admission, to begin to come, quote, in contact with the harsh realities of one of the most serious traumas of the Third World and the First, the reality of the so-called guest workers and their experience of racial, class, and sexual discrimination. End of quote. Freire goes on to indicate the fear of the oppressor as one of the challenges to be faced in this context, in view of the fact that the opportunity to work, irrespective of how exploitative the conditions are, becomes the primary concern. It is this concern that takes precedence over the concern for political mobilization to confront the exploitation induced by this process of mobility of labor power across national boundaries. This mobility involves, in most cases, a severance from one's roots, in view of the process of uneven levels of development that is a characteristic of the capitalist mode of production. Confronting the fear of oppression remains a key challenge here for progressive educators working with migrants. It is a key challenge for progressive educators working in the countries that many of these immigrants left. Of course, the foregoing point applies to most regions in the world, and not just the Mediterranean. What renders the whole process significant in the context of this region is once again the fact that the receiving countries are the same countries that once witnessed mass waves of emigration. These countries have experienced the shift from being exporters to importers of labor power. This is not the place to engage in a discussion concerning the way the prejudice and racism experienced by settlers from North Africa and elsewhere differs from that experienced in the past by emigrants from today's receiving southern European countries in such places as the United States, Canada, Australia, and South America. There are differences, and these have been documented, but it will take time to go into this. Nevertheless, in combating xenophobia and racism in this context, one would do well to recall the plight of people from the receiving country when settling abroad or in a more industrially developed region of the same country. For example, migrants from Italy's Mezzogiorno region settling in the country's north. The architectural and demographic landscapes of southern European cities are undergoing significant changes. Against this scenario, we are witnessing the transformation of southern European cities. While the population in these cities becomes increasingly becomes cosmopolitan, the architecture is often of a melange of the old coexisting with the new. The global exists alongside the local, that's why I've got the word local there, in a situation of hybridity. One can imagine, for example, Giotto's Campanile being juxtaposed against McDonald's twin golden arches. Furthermore, in certain southern European cities and towns, the cupolas of churches that for centuries were perceived as bulwarks of Christendom against Islam, increasingly, because they already had existed before, continue to coexist alongside minarets. Not to say that this did not happen. In fact, minarets have been used as belfries for churches like the Cathedral of Valencia, for instance, and the same applies on the other side. The Hagia Sophia, both in Istanbul and in Cyprus, across the Green Line. This coexistence of architectural symbols of the different monotheistic religions that have been the subject of much conflict in the past is becoming an important feature of the skyline of some southern European cities. Within this cultural hybridity, one can easily encounter the tensions that have characterized the regions for centuries. Xenophobia, or more accurately, Islamophobia, has become widespread. In Nawal el-Sardawi's words, the Egyptian writer, I quote, do we have a quotation? Yep. Perhaps the problem of the world has always been the objectification, the nullification of the other, alterity, l'alterità in Italian, no? For the West or the North, the South is the other, which exists only as an object to be exploited and oppressed. Christianity, or Western culture, sees Islam and Arab culture as the other. And in all regions, all that does not belong to God is seen as emanating from the devil. The problem of our world is to ignore, to dismiss, to destroy the other. To do this, the other must be satanized. It can be argued that the historical roots of this for this form of racism can be found, amongst other things, in the anti-Islamic crusades that left a mark in several places in this region, becoming a feature of the so-called cultural heritage. Cultures that for centuries had been constructed as being antagonistic are now expected to coexist within the same geographical space.
So, one of the great challenges for educators in this context would be that of confronting the fundamental issue of difference. The issue of difference is a moral one, involving questions of privilege and power. Because these questions often evoke discomfort, especially in groups whose members differ in their personal access to privilege and power, they may be avoided in classrooms. At best, they are replaced with more positive reflections of diversity. Too often, they are replaced with no questions at all. We regard the process of authentic dialogue as a key concept in Freirean pedagogical approach, as one of the best means to permit the different cultures that make up our societies to become an integral feature of the educational process, and allow participants to listen to others. Listening is here being used in the sense conveyed by Paulo Freire in Pedagogy of Freedom, where it was argued that listening is to be distinguished from simply hearing and implies one's being open to the word of the other, to the gesture of the other, to the differences of the other without being reduced to the other. Intimately linked to Freire's concept of authentic dialogue is Giroux's concept of border crossing. Crossing borders would, in this context, entail that critical educators step into the universe of representations with an attitude that transcends mere curiosity or lust for esoteric knowledge. Beyond the showcase knowledge, border crossing also means interrogating an assimilationist attitude towards the incoming other, an attitude that negates the self and reproduces dominant identities rather than one which affirms diversity. Moreover, crossing borders implies the intersection of dominant schooling processes and the family cultures of migrant populations. Such intersections aim at demarginalizing these populations' cultural capital and worldviews that at times are drastically different from those of educators. Border crossing problematizes the technicist approach to teaching. This approach skates over the issue of difference and acts as a carrier for reproductive discourses and ideologies. Border crossing is dynamic and therefore does not limit itself to a passive consumption of information about cultures. It is also flexible in curricular terms, a process not merely a method which is inclusive of different cultural expressions, including linguistic differences. The nomadic existence that characterizes the continued movement of millions of people challenges the Mediterranean school. Often schools fail to come to terms with the harsh existence experienced outside their perimeter. The educational institution overlooks the skills required for anyone to live successfully and chronically to in transit. Confronted by an insensitive context, the nomadic other is forced to assimilate the school culture rather than actively participate in its reinvention. Within this formula, the parent often becomes a co-player in resisting the school, while teachers are not always willing to participate in emancipatory projects. Support, coordination, and time for reflection are often lacking. Interculturalism does not feature strongly in the formation of prospective teachers and in continuous professional development programs. The Mediterranean school is still trying to come to terms with centuries of negation and assimilation policies and practices. Efforts are sporadic and disorganized. The net result is ghettoization and exclusion rather than inclusion. Rejection often dominates relations between the established community and its transient counterpart. Community conflicts, accentuated by poor economic performance and unemployment, are played out at school. Stereotypes and prejudices are replayed within the educational institution. The Euro-Mediterranean school is also plagued by structural realities. In a paper that deals with the Euro-Arab dialogue, Aziz Hasbi refers to a duality that is multidimensional in nature, one that deeply affects the learner's attitude towards the other. Quote, "The choice lies between education for the masses, which is hamstrung by budget shortfalls, and an elitist Western-style education accessible only to the minority who have the means to pay for private education or to leave the country and be educated abroad. The situation is sometimes complicated by the relocation of Western training, cutting off contact with local realities, and reinforcing the impression that local education is bankrupt." Unquote. In this case, educational provision intersects with social class to severely curtail cultural dialogue. Material alienation is regarded by Ali Arici as a serious impediment to dialogue. Quote, "Unfortunately, first-generation immigrants residing in Europe are almost always unreceptive to the host culture. As traditionalists, their main goal is to earn money so as to buy land or a house in their country of origin, and they do not always see the need of cohabitation and integration in the foreign country where they live and work." Unquote. Culture and social isolation, symptomatic of traditional family patterns, tend to prevent girls and women from accessing sites of cultural dialogue. Writing in the context of runaway Turkish children in Western Europe, Gunduz Vasaf explains that children who are least likely to run away are often children of closed families who live in splendid isolation away from school and other cultural sites. Cultural dialogue thrives in a healthy intellectual environment. The Euro-Mediterranean school is often operating in a context that is intellectually arid. Abdeljalil Akkari provides us with an insight into this issue. I'm quoting, "In contrast, the present situation is marked by a reluctance on the part of European researchers to work in the Arab world. The rapid rise in unemployment and scarcity of work among Arab academics trained in the region and the low level of return on the part of those educated in Europe are also signs unlikely to foster dialogue." Unquote. The various situations of conflict which characterize this region and which can cause tension in multi-ethnic societies render it indispensable to crossing borders in a variety of ways. Hasbi advocates a pragmatic dialogue, one that is sufficiently realistic and feasible. He stresses that dialogue must avoid the traps of mindless moralizing, and it must banish the mutually distrustful medieval attitudes shaped by the geography of barbarity and or unbelief of or towards a civilization or religion that believes itself to be superior. Unquote. Many of the southern European regions have traditionally been steeped in the Christian religion, mainly Catholic and also Greek Orthodox. In a truly multi-ethnic environment, it is imperative that knowledge of the different religions is provided in various sites of learning, including those regarded by Henri Giroux as sites of public pedagogy. There is always the danger, however, that one provides or constructs a caricature that, besides distorting reality, dehumanizes those being portrayed. The complexity of the situation can easily be ignored, with the religions being represented in simplistic terms. The study of different religions should therefore be approached with the utmost seriousness and best preparation possible, with special emphasis being placed on the critical educator doing justice to the different religions involved. This applies to critical education carried out in different sites, including courses for those involved in the mass media. In the case of the last mentioned, this would be in keeping with the recommendations of the 1997 Civil Forum Euromed. Quote, "Mass media are invited to present a correct image of religions or cultures, resorting, where suitable, to experts on the matter." Unquote.
Okay. We also must mention Islam as featuring also in the southern European regions. Let's not forget Turkey as well. And not just Turkey. We've got also Eastern Europe. Misconceptions regarding Islam abound in the Western world. We're talking now about the study of different religions, which we see as a very important area, provided it's done properly. Misconceptions regarding Islam abound in the Western world. Countries of Southern Europe, which are recipients of immigrants from Arab countries, are no exception. For greater conviviality and dialogue to occur between people of different ethnic backgrounds with different cultural and related knowledge traditions, an effort must be made to learn about others, to cross the boundaries of one's social location, and to obtain the understanding and knowledge necessary to to be able to engage in a critical reading of widely diffused texts, media images, news packages, representations in film and documentary, reading the construction of the world through the word, if we are allowed liberties with Paulo Freire's famous phrase. The phrase is reading the word and the world, but we've played around with this. This is necessary for one to be able to confront and problematize post-problems. This entails a problem-posing approach, in fact, to confront and problematize the politics of misrepresentation that results from historically entrenched prejudices and deep-seated antagonistic dispositions. One would do well in this context to keep in mind Paulo Freire's emphasis on the rigors of a problem-posing, dialogical approach to education and the need for educators to guard against the danger and insidiousness of a laissez-faire pedagogy. In many countries of Southern Europe, we are confronted by a Eurocentric cultural heritage that reflects a colonial past, especially in former centers of colonial power such as Spain and Portugal, and a past marked by crusades against the Ottoman Empire. A critical approach to education in the Southern European region would enable its participants to engage critically with the region's or country's much acclaimed cultural heritage, culture not being used in the anthropological sense, and this heritage's politics of representation. Exotic and often demonic misrepresentations of alterity, the other, abound throughout this cultural heritage, alterity historically having been ascribed in these areas to a variety of people, including the Saracen, who is regarded as the other in the context of quote-unquote Christian Europe. The other becomes a subject of a particular kind of construction, a form of Orientalism, according to Edward Said. This construction denotes a sense of positional superiority on the part of those who promote this particular conception of the other. It is a demonization reminiscent of the French colonial construction, quote, taught in the universities for over 20 years, end of quote, and based on so-called, quote-unquote, scientific proof of the colonized in Algeria and North Africa in general. The quotes are from Frantz Fanon, of course. Frantz Fanon, who forcefully exposed this thesis in his classic anti-colonial volume, The Wretched of the Earth. A Freirean approach to education in this region would entail a pedagogy that engages critically with the politics of representation underlying different features of the artistic and historical heritage of the various countries in the Southern European region. A similar politics of representation characterizes the realm of popular culture in Southern European countries, with the Sicilian marionette shows involving crusaders and predator, often the Saracen other, being a case in point. In introducing immigrants to popular cultural traditions in the receiving country, one ought to be wary of and highlight the contradictions found within these traditions, for it is precisely these contradictions that often contain stereotypical elements that denigrate significant cultural aspects of immigrants in Southern Europe. Furthermore, in challenging such representations and misconceptions, critical educators in this region and elsewhere would do well to recognize and point out the important contributions that Arab, Islamic, and other non-Eurocentric cultures have made towards the development of those aspects of science, medicine, mathematics, law, literature, theology, philosophy, architecture, learning, including the idea of the academy and the university, and other domains we have ethnocentrically come to associate with Western civilization. Hasbi stresses this point when he asserts that, quote, the knowledge and technologies which are the shared heritage of humanity were not created ex nihilo, but were built up in a lengthy process of accumulation to which every people has made its contribution. Efforts are now being made to give the West credit for a unique and absolute rationality and a creativity which are seen as consubstantial with it, demonstrating amnesia and ethnocentricity, end of quote. Civilizations are not to be presented in essentialist terms, but should be viewed as being characterized by a strong degree of hybridity. Unfortunately, these contributions are excised from popular knowledge and common sense, the term being used here in Gramsci's sense, and we are often guilty in our denigration of the cultural of alterity of what Mahmoud Salem el-Sheikh calls the debtor's syndrome. We translate from the Italian original in a paper called Le omissioni della cultura italiana. The person to whom one is indebted is constantly a hated person, particularly if the creditor, as in this case, is a strange body, rejected by the collective consciousness, hated by the political, social, cultural, and religious institutions. If anything, the rage against the creditor in these circumstances becomes an almost moral duty and a necessary condition for the survival of that society. We find this to be a very powerful quote. Cultural productions at the popular level and at the level of so-called highbrow culture can serve as codifications in the sense intended by Paulo Freire. In conceiving of such productions as codifications, we as critical educators would enable ourselves and those with whom we are working to engage in a critical reading of our contemporary reality. In the process, we must keep in mind that concepts that form part of our common sense can partly have their roots in cultural and folklore traditions. They are concepts that have been accumulated over a long historical period, but not necessarily from a critically historical or political point of reference. This points to the need for utilizing pedagogical activities that can help to critically unveil the important dimensions of immigrant student cultures that can serve in the interest of their intellectual development and academic success. With this in mind, we should like to dwell very briefly on one form of cultural production that, in our view, has tremendous potential to serve as an educational tool, which would enable educators working with immigrants to empathize with the fellow humans who have arrived from other shores. Drama is the form of cultural production we have in mind. Drama has functioned as an important educational tool, including a community learning tool, and it has been doing so for many years. The work of Augusto Boal and other cultural workers in various parts of the world is well documented in the popular education and community studies literature, and testifies to the effectiveness of theatre as a pedagogical tool. We also have people over here at the university who have worked on Boal, people like Vicky Cremona and John Schranz. And let's not forget also the work carried out by Mario Zopardi. Theatre of the oppressed in the classroom has served as a vehicle for the process of codification and decodification in that it incorporates important features of a Freirean praxis, namely collective reflection, dialogue and action in the formation of social consciousness. And although one must be wary not to make a fetish out of this process, drama can create powerful pedagogical experiences that foster greater inter-ethnic solidarity and understanding across cultural differences. One of us found quite instructive in this regard a dramatic representation to which participants at a 1998 conference on education in the Mediterranean held in Sestri Levante, Liguria, Italy, were exposed. It was carried out by a troupe of players from Genoa and involved the juxtaposition of situations concerning the harsh realities of migration, both past and present, the plight of Italians migrating to the United States, Argentina, and elsewhere, and of Italians from the south moving into the country's northern regions, was juxtaposed against that of Africans, including Arabs and Eastern Europeans, with their personal narratives moving into Italy. The scenes were poignant and quite revealing, based on a dialectical movement between past and present, a kind of redemptive remembrance, in Walter Benjamin's term, and the hope of a transformed and healthy multi-ethnic democracy. As critical educators, we must work to construct daily experiences of personal meaning and collective democratic participation in the teaching of immigrant students, through the use of a variety of pedagogical approaches that mirror the effectiveness of drama in the classroom. Undoubtedly, critical educators in the southern European region face many challenges in their efforts to develop a strong democratic citizenship in the multi-ethnic context of schooling. With this in mind, we conclude this essay by articulating, as a form of summing up, the following suggestions in the teaching of immigrant students. Incoming migrant groups should not be regarded as harboring deficits. The programs and experiences provided should be those in which the members of all ethnic groups involved, and we're all ethnic, including the ethnic groups to which the educators belong, in which are conceived of as subjects and not objects of the learning. Educational policy makers should avoid establishing programs that smack of what the Italians call assistenzialismo, that often results in a form of learned helplessness. Critical educators should be wary of misrepresenting and otherizing immigrant students as part of the hegemonic Western discourse. Critical educators require a good understanding of political economy and knowledge of how the economic system segregates along ethnic and national lines. Critical educators must become border crossers so that they can begin to understand something about the culture of others, including their religions. Critical educators in receiving countries need to recognize the contribution of others to the development of their own culture. This would include recognition of the contribution of non-European cultures to the development of aspects of what is termed, quote-unquote, Western civilization. The pedagogical approach could be one based on the key principles of liberatory education, found in the work of Freire and other theorists, including Martin Buber and a host of writers from North America, particularly with respect to the concept of dialogue that entails listening rather than merely hearing. Critical educators must recognize that being a migrant constitutes only one aspect of a person's multiple and shifting subjectivities, and the culture of origin intersects with a variety of other cultures that emerge from other aspects of the person's identity, namely a multiculturalism that incorporates gender, class, race, ethnicity, sexuality, age, and religion. A critical education should be based on the recognition that although the work factor weighs heavily on the minds of those who migrate, the notion of citizenship ascribed to them should not be a two-dimensional one, that of producer and consumer, but one whereby they are conceived of as social actors in a multicultural democracy. Schools should not remain isolated from the rest of the community, but should be an integral part of the community and the surrounding context, as conceived by all its multi-ethnic, multicultural, and biodiverse features. In light of the preceding point, schools should be constructed as multi-purpose community learning sites, with implications for curricula, administration, teacher educator formation, and school architecture. Migrants and other groups within the community should be able to feel a sense of ownership of and belonging with respect to the school that would appeal to their children's and their own frameworks of relevance, both during conventional school hours and after school hours, where physical adjustments need to be made for the creation of spaces that accommodate adults from the community. Although this is not an exhaustive list, it cannot be, it is intended to stimulate necessary dialogue amongst critical educators who struggle to create educational conditions within southern European schools conducive to the emancipatory needs of an expanding immigrant student population. Such dialogue is particularly necessary in these times of intensified economic globalization and the unprecedented movement of south of the equator populations to the north. Thanks.
Let me just open the discussion by thanking Carmel and Peter for an extremely well-crafted and well-organized talk, which has raised, I'm sure you would agree, a very large number of ideas. Thanks for the beautiful PowerPoint presentation. Thanks also for the the level of theory. I hadn't realized that you were both quite so engaged in a reevaluation and construction of general concepts of social theories. And this, of course, makes your presentation particularly interesting. I just want to open up with a few remarks and then leave the discussion open entirely to the audience. First, may I point out that Peter and Carmel are extending some of the themes which have been raised in earlier papers and seminars this year. We began in February with Professor Hedi Barawi, a Tunisian who has spent the last 20 years in the French department of the University of York in Toronto, outside Toronto, and has written many novels in French as well as in English. And he is particularly concerned with one of the issues you raised, which is multiculturalism. And he critiques the multiculturalism of Canada, despite its strides, because it really leads to a kind of coexistence. And this theme came out in your talk tonight, that you are criticizing theoretically the whole notion of coexistence. You're really trying to get us to think in terms of border crossings, of cultural bridging. And I think this is precisely what is so difficult. It's difficult in Canada, according to Hedi Barawi. It's clearly going to be difficult and is difficult in Malta. It's difficult in France. It's difficult everywhere. It's so difficult to really genuinely engage the other rather than just at the best nod politely at him, employ him as a laborer in a particular niche of the political economy, or tolerate them at a common school. You're really trying to talk about an imaginative engagement and a daily physical engagement with the other in our midst. And how this is to be accomplished, you've suggested in some ways, and I suggest that practically speaking, that's the very, very difficult issue which Maltese audiences really, really want to think about. My own feeling is, if I may just say this briefly before opening up the discussion to other members of the audience, my own feeling is this. I think that to get the teachers we now have in our schools to engage in this act of moral imagination is awfully difficult. To expect the majority of them to do this is awfully difficult. My suggestion would be that it's precisely in faculties of education where the teachers themselves are taught to use Marx's famous expression in the Theses on Feuerbach. That's where we generate new ideas, new possibilities, new ways whereby primary school teachers and secondary school teachers engage with Somali or Arab or other African immigrant children who happen to be in the school. So that's one obvious possibility, that you're talking about the university itself being a site for new forms of pedagogy. The other point I would like to raise is that the kind of moral imagination you envisage, the kind of border crossings you envisage, is very susceptible to what I call a community approach. Not a school approach, but an outside school approach. I think this is where we need more direct local government participation, citizen activity. EDGE, the student organization, had a very interesting three-day conference this time last year, precisely on refugees and immigrants. We had a number of workshops, and I was invited to one of them. And the suggestion to come out of our workshop was simple. It was that those who eat together think together, or at least begin to engage with each other. Indeed, what might be very, very useful is situations in which, if I may put it this way as a tiny practical possibility, immigrants, refugees cook for an audience, share their food with a Maltese audience. This is just one of many suggestions about the need for community engagement. So with those opening remarks, I want to hand over to the audience.
Thank you. Although this is not my subject really, but I found the talk very thoughtful and raises a lot of points which would really require profound discussion. One point that I would like to make, that which I haven't noticed in your talk, is that our educational system, mainly in all Europe, is really geared to teaching, to dealing with children. You are both in the Faculty of Education, and you know that teachers are trained to deal with children. They study psychology of children, they know how to deal with problem children and everything children, while most of the migrants are adults. And in our case, in for example in Malta, adult education is really a very minor branch. We have very few people trained in teaching adults. So even when it comes to teaching language to people who don't speak English, migrants, we really do not know how to deal with them probably. Usually children of immigrants do not cause problems. They can mix in schools because teachers are trained to help them, and so are our schools. So one thing that, I mean, maybe one of the problems is that in immigration we have to deal with adults who already have their own prejudices, they have their own education, and therefore you cannot put them in class and just teach them like children. So you have to be trained perhaps how to deal with them, how to help them. It's not as simple, as straightforward as talking about education, you know. I find that is one of the problems.
As a faculty, we have been striving hard to broaden the concept of education. Now, it is true, and for obvious logistical reasons and other things, that the bulk of our resources goes into teacher preparation. But we have numerous programs targeting adults. I mean, I'm responsible for the program in this regard, the diploma in adult education, which does unfortunately not draw a large number of people, because people see the community aspect as being more voluntary. Now, this is going to change probably, because with true ESF funding, there are at least 7 localities now who have started a community learning project, and that will expand gradually. And we have been heavily involved in this because we helped with the National Curriculum Council to create a community learning program as preparation for those who would like to join these centers. There's also a program in adult training and development where the issue of social difference in all its context, including bio difference, by the way, is given a lot of importance. We have people like Vince Caruana who actually teach in this. We also have a master's degree program. We've got our third intake now in adult education. I mean, Tracy here is one of the students in the master's program, soon to graduate, in fact, who, you know, we've been doing this. We've also had units in the past in the BEd program, also amongst our teachers in adult education, because some of them will end up teaching adults too. Some of them now even on a full-time basis, because we've got the Lifelong Education Center. So I think we've done a lot. It still is the Cinderella of the educational system, that is true. And as you know, most of the European organizations still channel most of their money into the formal system. Globally, the World Bank has put most of its money into the formal system, so adult education has lost out. European Union now, with the Grundtvig projects, within Socrates, might be changing the scenario a bit, trying to make the rhetoric of lifelong learning a reality, etc. So, yes, we've been striving hard. We don't have a Department of Adult Education yet, which will probably give the subject the status it deserves at the university. Hopefully that will happen, will materialize eventually when the scene out there becomes even stronger. But I think some progress is being made. I think this thing about community learning centers that we have now is a big start. And of course, we also have this in the curriculum, and I would allow Carmen can talk about this, where there's also provision for the first time in a national document for adult education through schools as community learning centers.
Yes, Antoine, I do share your concern. I mean, unfortunately, to add to your concern, functionality tends to define the adult education, you know, landscape. In other words, adult education for employment, adult education for specific skills. And within that context, it's very difficult to engage, you know, in critical debates on issues which are pertinent to particular societies. So that is definitely a problem. The other problem is that most of our educators were brought up, or rather were socialized within the transmission model of curriculum development and teaching. In other words, basically a technicist approach to teaching, whereby teachers are there to transmit knowledge from, syllabi to students. And within that context, within that framework, it's very difficult for teachers to switch, codes and become critical debaters or people who are genuinely engaged in critical debates or critical dialogues. So we have a dual problem there. A, the paradigm, the adult education paradigm, which is dominated by, this intimate link between adult education and, vocational issues like employment and skills. And also the other aspect of, adult educators, socialized in a curriculum model which is dominated by this traditional approach or transmission approach to teaching.
Mm-hmm. There's some interesting work from the FES in this regard as well, the Foundation for Education Services.
Going into this further into this point, it emerges, of course, that the technicist approach to education is not something that is confined to secondary schools. We find in the university itself that there is a very strong tendency. It's not so much emphasized as simply part of the culture, the educational culture, to transmit in class and for what are effectively adult students to receive and reproduce. One might add small points, like, for example, the one-hour format encourages this. You're rushing through material, and they are trying to get it down. The two-hour format encourages more discussion, but there's a wholly different attitude involved when you're dealing with difficult texts. In my subject, anthropology, for example, you're talking about this culture, or you're talking about an African culture, or you're talking about an Asian culture, and you're comparing them. To impart the idea to students that what is involved is not simply learning in the old-fashioned sense, imbibing factual material, but rather engaging in a critical dialogue with the lecturer and with other members of the class as part of the very process of research and development. And that clearly needs to be thought of when we think of community centers, lifelong learning. We're not asking people to go into courses and sit there as they used to when they were younger and copy down what the lecturer or the professor is saying, an approach which is still far too common in the University of Malta. They are rather asking for a format of true lecturing, true introductions, true texts which have to be encountered by the student, but then it's open. It's open for discussion. And this is a different mentality which has got to become important. If you're talking about lifelong learning of people in the community, and you're perhaps devising courses which introduce them to new religions and introduce them to immigrants on the spot. It's a different approach to learning altogether.
That's right. We do not have a long tradition in creative and critical thinking. That's one of the problems. Also, unfortunately, transmission is perceived as being very efficient. And in the context of adult education, where immediacy and results are conceived and perceived as being very important, transmission comes in handy. So that's the issue. It's a vicious cycle there.
Just a second. We have... Okay. You notice that the discussion has moved from the Southern European scene, which is the base of our paper, but that's no problem. That's the way we'd like it to be, to the Maltese scene. Mm-hmm. So certain issues we cannot raise here. Because one of the major issues that we have to think of, I'm teaching a course right now, and we have a class tomorrow, in fact, on the subject, is about adult education in small states. Adult education in small states. A particular situation concerning small states. And the issue of ethnicity takes on a very important, a great importance in a small state like ours. The microstate, densely populated, small landmass. Xenophobia is found all over the world. There's a book coming out soon called The Globalization of Racism, which deals with situations in various countries. What form does racism take in various places? Which includes Italy, written by a Sicilian, from Messina, Malta, written by us, but there are other, Germany, there's Zygmunt Bauman in this book, etc. But in a small state, the incidence of xenophobia is likely to be bigger for the very simple reason, there's always this fear. Look at the debate, the way it goes. Those people who are, I'm not saying people who incite racial prejudice, I'm talking people who take on a particular position. We are small, we'll be swamped aside. A few people can swamp us aside. So, you know, like xenophobia in a small country like ours takes on a particular significance, peculiar to small micro states. And, of course, there is a reality which we have to face. I mean, we are densely populated. Now, I'm not talking about the clash of cultures, whatever, because I find this a very facile dichotomy. But there is a reality to be faced. And here, I think, adult education can play a very important role. There could be a two-pronged effort. One, adult education for integration. The term today is social cohesion. It tends to skate over difference, this term, social cohesion, but that's the term which is being used now. And also, why not, adult education for relocation, which means a proactive work on our part with governments abroad who can entice many of these migrants who don't want to stay here in Malta, actually, it was not their intention to come here. And, of course, that what that will entail is teaching languages belonging to that particular country where they would like to go and work. Now that depends on, you know, I mean, it's on relations between, say, Malta and Sweden or Malta and other countries. But that means, therefore, the curriculum will have to be informed by material from Sweden, Finland, etc. Okay, I can't imagine Italy taking, you know, wanting to take in more, but, you know. So adult education for relocation because of the peculiar situation of a microstate like ours, densely populated with also a small landmass.
Do you want to record? So there's really lots of issues that we have been mentioning, and I'm going to try to give my input on a few of those. First of all, this kind of issue, which is an issue that is very contentious and is bound to make a lot of noise and clatter wherever it is mentioned, quite often sprouts in universities, and from there it hopefully starts to spread around. Now, one of the first places where it should spread to is the education department, because from there it would then go onto the educators which are out there in the field, because as Antoine mentioned earlier, the adults need to be educated, the Maltese adults need to be educated, and among these Maltese adults are in fact the educators. Now I'm going to put a question over here. What kind of links are present at the moment between the faculty of education within the university and the government's education department?
Well, in terms of links, I think in terms of the issue of multiculturalism, the links are rather loose. To be fair with education authorities, they do have an educational officer, okay, focusing on citizenship. And obviously multiculturalism does come up within the context of citizenship. Unfortunately, as I read the situation, it's more of the liberal conception of multiculturalism. Let's affirm and let's celebrate. Okay, it's not the kind of multiculturalism that we are advocating here, radical or rather critical multiculturalism. But to be fair with education authorities, okay, they do have a person who is specifically focusing on the issue of citizenship. And obviously they see multiculturalism as a subset of that overarching term citizenship. And the same person is a part-time lecturer within the Faculty of Education. So relationships are loose, but they are there.
Very positive start.
Yes, absolutely.
My second issue would be the multicultural learning. There's the African culture, the Mediterranean culture, the European culture. But what is actually, and learning about them is fine, but what is actually happening is that these cultures are changing. And the Maltese culture
if it adopts part of the African culture and part of the Asian culture, it will itself change. So that is something which is very causes a lot of concern within the people.
That raises the issue of Eurocentrism. It's nice to see finally people from India giving talks here, for instance. Not that it did not happen in the past, but you know, our upbringing. I mean, we base most of our education on a very Eurocentric view of the world. Now that is changing, of course, but you know, old habits die hard. I have no doubt that our culture can be, multi-society will be enriched by a greater opening up to a variety of cultures, not just looking up north, but also looking down south. And I don't mean down in a pejorative sense, I mean. So, definitely, but there will be a lot of resistance, for sure. But, you know, I mean, things start slowly. We've introduced in our faculty Southern writers. Other faculties are doing the same thing. There's a new breed of academics in the university, I would say, in literary theory, for instance, etc., who are bringing in this a whole, and in anthropology and in history too, who are bringing in a new way of viewing things, and you know, I mean, these things take time; won't happen.
As we become increasingly multicultural, the challenge would be for these, you know, cultures, for this multiplicity of subjectivities to move towards the center and form part of our culture, collective cultural capital, rather than, you know, lingering at on the periphery.
Needs to be addressed. I think clearly, if we move beyond cultural coexistence, sort of Hedy Barawi's term for the official multiculturalism of Canada and Quebec, to cultural border crossing, as you termed it in your paper, then the issue which arises is one of mutual change. In anthropology, we often cite Frederick Barth, who in all his work on cultural brokerage emphasized that what the cultural broker does is, by bringing together two or more cultures, he initiates a change in all of those cultures. When you exchange with another culture, intellectually or economically, both are likely to change. Of course, you're presenting a case in a capitalist sphere of the global economy in which the immigrant is envisaged as staying at a rather simple level of the labor market. You can, to use your own term, segment him so he stays in one part of that market. Of course, immigrants aren't like that. Immigrants are always trying to improve wherever they go, are trying to improve their position. Your point about xenophobia must be true. In microstates, there is a very special twist to the whole issue of cultural bridging, border crossing, a very special worry. We are small. They will swamp us. You don't even look at the facts and figures. I mean, it would be germane to look at the number of immigrants coming in. It seems large, but vis-a-vis Malta's 380,000 people, it's really still quite small. The second point is that preliminary research by Ruth Faruja, who gave one of the talks in this theory, suggests that the majority of clandestini are very well educated. They're the kind of people who had the cultural capital and the economic capital to make the journey across the desert and across the sea in the boats in the first place. We're looking at people who have a very definite contribution. That, of course, was the main point I tried to make in the symposium 2 weeks ago. I can understand people's alarm at a relatively unskilled labor force coming into a microstate, but a skilled labor force may have a great deal to contribute to that microstate.
If I can make another point. In your paper, you deal mainly with the relations between migrants and residents of the host country. which in Malta is fine, because usually, at least at the moment, migrants are coming from just from Africa, from sub-Saharan Africa. Mm. But in bigger countries, like for example Britain, you get migrants themselves coming from different areas, Caribbean, Pakistani. So there's also the problem of interaction between groups of migrants themselves, not only between Britons and migrants. Yeah. And that can also be perhaps even more difficult, because there you are dealing, you have to, for example, educate Caribbeans to sort of accept Pakistani culture, okay? Yeah. Where you have British educators trying to talk, to educate Jamaicans not to accept only British culture and vice versa, but even having a third party or fourth, you know, I mean, in large countries, you get all these small groups, and they have all their own prejudices and their own interactions, which makes it very complicated.
Well, we can learn a few lessons also from the United States, where some of the great racism takes place between ethnic groups. Well, they're all ethnic groups, but you know, Irish and Italians, etc. We will have that situation here too, because religion plays a very important part about migrants. You've got Catholics, Protestants, you've got Islam, Christian, Arabs, etc. coming here. So I can see some differences there, and also differences. That would be another mistake we do if we refer to migrants as one unitary force, when in actual fact they are a heterogeneous group, different cultures, etc. And they will also have to deal with the issue of relations amongst themselves. So that would be a very, very important issue. Back to the whole issue of being swamped aside. It's interesting, because we always pride ourselves on being a very democratic country, and I hope we remain like that. But in other small states, the whole issue of democracy has been called into question for people to defend the indigenous culture. Fiji is the classic example. Fiji would be the classic example of a micro-state which would stage a series of coups, because Indians have been taking over. So, you know, that is another concern.
Yes. In our case, we are also a border state. We're not Luxembourg, for example. Mm-hmm. So we feel that we have to affirm our European identity more than other countries. Another point, if I may mention, is the teaching, because you mentioned the teaching of religion. Mm-hmm. I think that is the most sensitive issue, because it deals with the supernatural. And while most people would accept that, well, most parents would accept that you teach their children about different cultures, they cannot accept that you put different religions on the same level, because it's a question of faith. You know, you cannot put Jesus and Muhammad on the same level. So that can perhaps be one of the issues which would create most resistance among locals.
Can you give us some experience?
In terms of the Faculty of Education, 2 years ago, we introduced at primary level a course called World Religions. So there we are introducing our prospective teachers to this multifaceted, you know, situation of different religions. In the local context, obviously Catholicism is privileged, and it is privileged legally, okay, both through first through the constitution, and secondly through the concordat between Vatican and state. And unfortunately, within the national minimum curriculum, there are references, you know, to the multiple situation in terms of religions, respect for other religions, etc. But from the document of 1998-99, the Catholic religion emerged as a privileged religion once again. So there you have a contradiction in terms. On one hand, a document that foregrounds inclusion and diversity, but on the other hand, at the same time, privileging one basic religion, Catholic religion. So unfortunately, that's the situation right now in terms of the curricular vision and the curricular context for this country.
And the other thing is also, what's the vantage point when you're teaching religions? Is there, you know, you could be teaching about religions, but from a center, And that could create interesting issues. There is also a need to be more sensitive to the textbooks we are using in our schools. Some of them are really out of date, and it could be also insensitive. We've written about this, and some people have criticized us in the newspapers, insensitive to especially with regard to Islam. You know, the way people get depicted, the face of Muhammad appears in the history textbook. You know, this is not acceptable it never was acceptable, but more so now. The first people to raise a hue and cry about this was our Arab teachers in the 80s, who we used to share our staff rooms, 70s and 80s, who pointed this out. And now we may not have that number of Arab teachers, but we've got Arab students in our schools. So yeah, there should be more greater sensitivity.
I think your point about history is very well taken. I think getting back to the Southern European theme, you opened up by saying two things. You opened up by saying that one has to realize that Southern Europe as a whole was a huge labor exporter and now is a labor importer. And this is so true. And we need social histories, creative, simple social histories for children, for it as well as for adults, which allow them to understand how much, if I may put it this way, Maltese, Italians, Greeks, all obtained from migrating out, and therefore to be able to imagine how much others could obtain from Malta. It's a different way of conceiving of immigration, not as a threat, but as a worldwide movement which has led to the gain of many and could lead also to the gain of Malta. The other point you mentioned historically is that we have a special problem throughout Southern Europe. It was the cultural border, as Antoine and you yourselves mentioned, it is the cultural border between Islam and Christianity. And this needs to be thought about. This needs to be thought about so that both Islam and Christianity can be presented in ways which are more understanding of each other. But it is a very real barrier which has to be overcome. It's different from trying to encourage multicultural education, say, in Holland. Here, this is the border, and it still is the cultural border. Something.
You spoke about the drama technique, which can be used in schools to tackle this issue. I would like to be informed more on the workout and the coordination of the drama. How can it help?
We're not drama experts, and there are people at this university and also outside the university, people like Mario Mazzopardi, for example, who's also teaching in our faculty right now. Who are much more well-versed than we are in this field, because they focus primarily on, people like him, focus primarily on community theatre. The most favoured approach, from my reading of the situation, seems to be that of Augusto Boal. Now, I wouldn't say that he's the only person doing this sort of thing, but he seems to have captured the imagination of some of the people I know. And where basically there's a strong similarity between the pedagogical approach of Paulo Freire, that many of you know about.
Could you please give that name again?
Augusto Boal.
How do you spell the last name, please?
B-O-A-L. There is a very strong link between his dramatic theatrical approach and the whole idea of the pedagogical approach of Paulo Freire. It's all based on praxis, the older concept which goes back to at least Aristotle, where you take a critical distance from the reality you know to be able to see it in a more critical vein. And so, you know, I mean, a lot has been written about this. We are not the best people to answer that question. However, having said that, there was an interesting thesis written by Mario Zoppardi at MPhil level, where, you know, he's looking at Maltese theatre, and the Boalian approach comes out very strongly in his work, and I believe that was also part of his book for the PIN publications on the theatre in Malta. Vicky Cremona has also written about this. He's got a piece in the book Beyond Schooling, which deals with the kind of approach and certain experiments which had taken place in the past. So, you know, there are some sources to look up here. We've been on a lecturing tour of Italy recently and doing Freirean pedagogical workshops as well as seminars, and many of the people involved were not just, well, they were educators and community activists. Many of them were actually people involved in acting, because they were very much interested in the Freirean approach. The Jolly group. Jolly is a very key figure in the Boal technique, the Jolly, in Bologna. For example, they were the ones who invited us to do it in Bologna. We presented the pedagogical approach. We actually created workshops. And so there's quite a lot of interesting stuff coming out of Italy. By the way, the Italians, we can learn a few lessons from the Italians, also when it comes to the teaching of religions. There's a lot of work being taking place in various parts of Italy. Most of it is in Italian, so it does not get an international resonance. We can access the language. There's a lot of interesting work coming out of Italy on North-South relations, on the issue of migrations, lots of books being published based on grassroots activity. There's a very strong sense of social movements in Italy, I feel, right now. And also there is an organization called IRSE. I forgot now what the acronym stands for, which have been doing a lot of work and projects around the teaching of world religions. So, you know, Italy is a very good place to look at right now for material. Country, so yeah, well, yeah, there's lots of material coming out of Italy right now.
You mentioned that immigrants are like segregated and they feel oppressed. We have even a small percentage of Maltese who do yoga, do meditation, marry these people, they change their religion, and they feel oppressed. They don't show it to other Maltese. So this is another issue. Mm. I don't...
Mm. Can you elaborate on that a bit?
I mean, today we are mixing the cultures and many people are open. I know many Maltese who do meditation, they do yoga, but they wouldn't go public about it. They mix with Indian people, but they don't show it to the public.
Because they fear prejudice?
Yes, and they're being oppressed. They're being, if the public knows that this people, he married a Muslim and he changed his religion, yeah, he would be segregated but by Maltese.
Well, we had a case of a colleague at university whose house is daubed with paint because she appeared on television, mm-hmm, defending her marriage to, you know, mm-hmm, and there was a terrible reaction to what she said. Yeah.
Although in the case, because I remember she was not only, she not only said that she's married to a Muslim, but she also criticized certain extremist Muslims even in Malta. Mm. I remember that program.
Yes.
So the reaction could have been from both sides, actually. Mm. I'm not sure whether, maybe she knows who did it, but it could be coming from both sides, actually.
Yeah, that's true.
Peter Carmel, do you want to make a final comment on the discussion?
Well, one of the issues I think we have to, I hope this serves its purpose, as I said, the paper focuses on Southern Europe, so it's not confined to Malta. But if we're going to draw something from it, the most obvious thing to say, and it is not that obvious yet, apparently, is that the whole issue of multi-ethnicity is probably the most pressing issue we have in education at the start of this new millennium. And we have to start addressing this issue quickly at all levels of work, not just in education, but it has to be given more importance in education. And I think we have not recognized this yet. We know about the issue, but we have not recognized it as a key issue in education, probably the key issue, in my view, for education in this beginning of the millennium. Yes, there are other issues. We still have a very selective system, and this will have an effect also on migrants. So we still have an elitist and exclusive system. Look at the resistance we had to the curriculum. This will also have an effect on migrants. I mean, it's not just class issues. So this is one of the big issues you have to tackle. And even our faculty, I think we have to give it much more importance. We have started, we have courses, but it needs to get bigger and bigger. And it has to feature more strongly in our policy documents.
Well, what Peter is saying calls for more empirical research in the area. We do have some research. It's very indicative. When we went for quantitative, you know, methodologies, the perceptions were very positive because obviously they were based on self-reporting, okay, from the teacher's point of view. But when we went qualitative, when we triangulated, you know, the quantitative with qualitative, unfortunately, okay, the picture was not that positive. Okay, so definitely we need more research in this area to be able to gauge the general perception with regard to, you know, multiculturalism, etc.
One final thing also about now the paper, about the whole issue of critical pedagogy or critical approaches to education. I think what we're doing with this paper, and we're not the only ones, I mean, our colleague Ronald Sultan has also done some work in this respect. We are trying to introduce into the international discourse in the English language a Southern European perspective, because up to now most of the literature has been dominated by very Anglo-American writings, and from a third world perspective, from a third world perspective, I would say Latin American perspectives, because of course, as I mentioned earlier on, they draw a lot on Paulo Freire, so the Latin American perspective is given importance. So it's what we try to do is to bring in this particular perspective, and that's why they wanted it. I think they chose this paper for the special issue of cultural studies, critical methodologies, focusing on critical pedagogy. We hope to take this further. We've already done work in this field. We've written papers together. We hope this book will produce eventually Learning and Social Difference, for which we have a contract now with Paradigm Publishers in the United States. But based, this is interesting, on Maltese data. The book will be based on Maltese data. We'll also take this work a bit further. And, of course, I try to do something in my own book, Liberating Praxis, on Paulo Freire, to say something new, basically, where I've included a chapter on reinventing Freire in a southern context, the Mediterranean. And I managed to sneak that into an American publishing house product, which is not easy. Although Mediterranean is still a large context, you know. I even actually managed to sneak in a chapter on Malta at the end. But anyway, so yeah, we're trying to put this on the international agenda, the English-speaking agenda, because the French obviously do this kind of work, and also Italians do this work, but it's not well known outside the French-speaking and Italian-speaking world. That's it. The French will be more well known, probably North Africa, etc.
Thank you very much. I think one of the practical possibilities which emerges from tonight's discussion and seminar is that we actually need more workshops which bring together in Malta, with the University of Malta as its host, people in Italy, Greece, Sicily, and other parts of Southern Europe who have been working in the area of community drama, who have been working in the area of adult education, and who can discuss their critical reflections on the ways in which cultural border crossing, cultural bridging is being attempted in those countries. And I hope maybe we may consider in the future the possibility of Malta University being the host for such a Mediterranean workshop on border crossing and how it's being practically attempted in various parts of Southern
Europe.
Well,
I mean, there's been a lot of interesting work in this regard. Professor Sultana's Center for Euro-Mediterranean Research and Education has been producing a journal called Mediterranean Journal of Educational Studies, which deals with these issues. And also they held seminars, international seminars. Many of them were held in Malta, in fact. They were originally referred to as the Seven Moon Seminars, which subsequently took place abroad. In adult education, we have a Mediterranean network. We're working towards an association now. It's ironically funded by a German organization, because we need the funds. That's one of the big problems in the Mediterranean. The organizations that don't have the funds to bring people together. And we had a conference in Malta last two years ago, and there was two in Cyprus. The second one, Cyprus came in the last minute as a stopgap, because it was supposed to take place in Tunisia. But what, you know, what happened was a change of government, and they stopped the whole thing. That's the first. We were going to try and have it for the first time in an Arab country, and it didn't work out. But next one will probably be in Alexandria. So we've been also working at that level there. With regard to foreign people, we have quite a network of. I mean, Ronald Sultana has quite a network of educators in the Mediterranean. Next month, I'll be going to Naples and Catania to continue the work we've been doing in Bologna, Milano, and Rome on Freirean pedagogy. And there's a very interesting person in Catania, a very good friend of Professor Sultana, a friend of mine too now, who's created a Mediterranean Comparative Education Society. And it's become part of the World Congress of Comparative Educations, and now the next World Congress will take place in Sarajevo as a result of this initiative. And there's interesting stuff going on there. And Catania had an interesting project called Casa dei Popoli. They used the old, when the DS had the mayor, Bianco, who eventually became Minister of the Interior in Italy, and they had this idea of converting the old Marxist concept of Casa del Popolo, the Italian Communist Party, into Casa dei Popoli. The idea is that the different peoples of Catania come together, not just the foreigners who have come in, but also the Catanese of second generation. I don't know what the name would be for people of Catania, but anyway, they would be there and they learn from each other, this thing you're talking about. But everybody has to learn from each other. Everybody's an ethnic group. Casa dei Popoli is very interesting. It's something worth looking at. My guess is, I don't know whether they sustain the funding of that, but it will be interesting. I'll check it out next time I go there. And there are people who can come easily, and some of them also can speak English. So, I mean, they can deliver the presentation in English. So, you know, Pampanini will be one of them. Very interesting. He's just created an adult education center there. He's created the Mediterranean Comparative Education Society. Well, I mean, there you go. I mean, you've got to start.
Thank you very much, Carmel and Peter. 3 years ago, they gave a paper to this seminar series for an agenda against racism in Maltese education. And when they gave that paper, two things resulted. The first immediate result was that there were primary school teachers in the audience who contested the paper. But that's precisely the kind of atmosphere we want to encourage. There's bound to be contestation and disagreement, and it's through that new ideas get discussed and generated between people who are fearful of immigrants and people who are positive about immigrants. And the other point is that Peter's paper 3 years ago and Carmel's paper 3 years ago on against the racist agenda in education has in fact led to an increasing number of seminars over the last 3 years in the Work in Progress seminar series being devoted to the whole issue of cultural pluralism and the whole issue of immigrants and clandestini in the Maltese context. So thank you very much again.